All right, thank you, Joy. And yes, I did have a long title. It looked really good several months ago in my office, hence I have the colon there, so I did shorten it a little bit. So, what I'd like to talk to you about today is some of the work we've been doing at the University of Tennessee. We've thought about LEDs for about 5 years, and we've been working with LEDs for about four. We got a couple of SBIRs with Bob Morrow at Orbitech, and so Carl Sams and I have been working in this area for quite a while, and we're trying to tie in the effects of LEDs or single channel or single nanometer wavelengths to some of the quality factors, especially in specialty crops. And I'll repeat a lot of the information from the first two speakers. So when we first started looking at LEDs, obviously 5 years ago when I hit the literature and was speaking with Carl, a lot of people were on the red far red range. You know, the floriculture people with all the effects that the red and far red ratios would have on flowering and seedling germination, etc. There are very few people on the blue range. And we've heard some presentations this morning about the impacts of the blue wavelengths, and I want to try to help this morning to kind of tie it into some of the work we've been doing at Tennessee, especially with carotenoid physiology, which is one of my focus areas, and Carl really specializes in the glucosinolates and mineral elements, so I'll share that with you too. So real quickly, I know we've discussed this in the first two talks about just light perception by plants and what is actually being driven or what is actually being received by plants. Obviously, the phytochromes are on the red, far red range. We've already talked about the blue light sensing pigments in there, the cryptochromes and the phototropins. And each one of those will actually sense the blue light environment and either start a cascade event that leads to sort of a gene expression or actually, you know, turn on receptor kinases, which would actually lead to more signal transduction there. And really what we're focusing on in our program there at Tennessee is this idea that there could be some blue light reception and certainly blue light harvesting within the carotenoid pathway and certainly with zeaxanthine, because that's been actually theorized to be a blue light receptor. Okay, just looking at how zeaxanthine actually functions in plant physiology, not only does it really work in non-photochemical quenching, but also blue light sensing, and these are some characteristic charts here as far as what is actually happening to zeaxanthine levels and especially how it relates to guard cell functioning and opening and closing of the stomates. And you can see there on the left that when you look at the amount of zeaxanthine that they can actually identify in the guard cells and the mesophyll cells, it actually will peak with light irradiation. Okay, so hence there's a connection between the blue light perception and zeaxanthine levels. And over here, when you actually talk about the action spectra that will actually open and close the stomates, if they overlay that with the absorption spectra of zeaxanthine, which is a characteristic double hump in the blue range of most of your carotenoid pigments with the chromophore that develops, you can see that they overlay very nicely. Oops, let's go back. There we go. Okay. So in conclusion, I mean, if you look in the literature, there is a really good connection between the blue light perception and zeaxanthine within plants. I'm going to try to give you a little bit of information of some of the work that we've done to actually make the close connection between carotenoid levels, especially zeaxanthine, and non-photochemical quenching. You've heard from the two previous speakers about FB over FM, photochemical quenching, but it's the non-photochemical quenching that really has the role of carotenoids actually in there. Zeaxanthine itself, I mean, I'll tell you what it does in the human body here in just a second, but it helps to stabilize the thylakoid membrane and also membrane lipids to prevent peroxidative damage. It's been a little bit, it kind of falls out of the realm of most of the other carotenoids, that it's actually been identified as an intercellular and an extracellular antioxidant. And really, when you talk about the health effects, zeaxanthine is really important. It's hard to find in the vegetable kingdom. I've tried it, and it's a little bit easy to induce, but it's actually hard to find some of the species out there that will actually absorb it. So if I'm chasing a white rabbit in my career, it's actually going to try to find a species that has a high amount of zeaxanthine and one that you can actually enhance that in there. So hence this idea of, is it possible to improve carotenoid and especially zeaxanthine levels in specialty crops, and would LEDs with their narrow band wavelengths allow that to happen in an easy fashion? Okay, real quickly, as far as the connection between carotenoids and eye health, we heard the previous speaker talk a little bit about this, but it's really the two important carotenoids, lutein and zeaxanthine, that we get from our fresh fruits and vegetables that go into the macular pigment. And the macular pigment is the little white or the yellow streak here that's in the back of your macular region, and that's your blue light filter. Okay, that's your 100% UV blocking that you buy your sunglasses with. What happens when people age is they reduce their intake of fresh fruits and vegetables due to problems with their digestion. They lower the amount of carotenoids carotenoids that are being taken in. They reduce the amount of macular pigment, and now they let in possible UV damage that could damage the rods and cones in that central part of the vision. And if you know anybody with macular pigment, they can see on the periphery, but it's right that central focus area that gets blurred. And you can imagine trying to drive and function with that. The two forms out there, real quickly, there's a wet form and there's a dry form. Wet form is corrective because that's just a leakage of the drusen, and the dry form actually happens in a slow progression, but there's really no cure for that. So it's really, what can we do as far as preventative nature or prescribe people that they actually consume high amounts of carotenoids in there. And here is the distribution, and this is really how you can connect the amount of carotenoids that come in through specialty vegetables. And in fact, right there in that central part of the fovea, you can see the huge concentration of zeaxanthin and the limited extent of lutein. And that's where it does the light harvesting and the photoprotection there for your eyes. Looking at the literature, when we talked about this idea of light perception in plants, I found one example, and this was a science paper that came out a few years ago, of actually using the blue light reception to initiate gene transduction in a mammalian system like this mouse model here. And really, they were focusing on this melanopsin pigment, and it's going to absorb the blue light, and there it creates a signal cascade events and eventually goes to a genetic expression. And they were able to put an inducible marker in here, and that's down here. It might be hard to see in the back of the room, but this inducible marker in this mouse model, they saw that if they irradiated the mice with blue light for a short period of time, these dark bars here are the blue irradiation and the open bars there are just the regular light, and they were able to induce this selective marker that they had in there, the biomarker, just through the strobing of blue light. So what happens in plants can also be translated into a mammalian system, which was really interesting. Okay, so we're talking about light-emitting diodes in the colloquia. So most of us are familiar with the mechanics of what actually happens and how they're actually produced. In working with Orbitech or Orbital Technologies, we work with their engineers to produce the diode arrays that we actually have. We have one-by-one arrays, and I was able to retrofit those into the Conviron grow chambers. And with Carl's help, we put four into each chamber. They're in the rack, so the rack will go up and down. And, of course, with the amount of power that goes in, that gave us our light intensity. So not only can we change their location to the plant, but we can also change the amount of intensity that are going in there. And in consulting with the engineers, Carl and I decided that, you know, we wanted different configurations. So we have red, blue, and we have red, blue, green, and we're actually starting to branch out to look at the other wavelengths too, a little bit of IR, a little bit of UV, etc. Okay, I want to go through a series of studies to kind of describe what we've been doing at Tennessee over the past couple of years. The first one is actually comparing regular light bulbs to LEDs and measure their impacts on plant stress. So with the chambers that we had there, we were able to compare a regular incandescent environment with an LED environment and then measure some of these stress indicators in plants. So what we use is dwarf Siberian kale as a model. We grew it under the optimum temperatures. Our light intensity was 250 micromoles across all treatments under a 16-hour photo period. The light treatments that we used were just the regular incandescent banks that are in the Conviron E15s. And then we had our LED treatment here, which was 5% blue, 95% red, and then 20% blue, 80% red. So we can adjust those different levels at the same light intensity there. We harvested them at baby kale stage. Okay, this was in pot culture in soilless media. And then we brought them in the lab, and then we measured them for pigments, and then we also measured them for chlorophyll fluorescence under a fluorocam that would indicate photochemical and non-photochemical quenching. So we looked at this just like the previous speakers alluded to, is that when you grow the plants under the different types of light, you know, whether it's the control treatment or the low blue and the high blue, QY max or FE over FM stays pretty consistent. Okay, it stays about the 0.78 or 0.79 that it should. But if you look at NPQ, which is non-photochemical quenching, which is indicative of the high light environment stress, you can see under the control experiment here, or the control, which is incandescent fluorescence, it's much higher than the 5% blue and the 20% blue. So this is indicative of that stressful environment. Okay, and since we can do carotenoid physiology in the lab, we can actually take the leaf, put it under the floor cam, turn around, digest it, and run it on the HPLC, which is right across the bench. And in doing that, you'll see this dramatic connection between zeaxanthin and NPQ. So here are the leaf tissue's xanthophyll carotenoids that are actually present in the kale tissue. Again, the incandescent fluorescent, the 5% blue and the 20% blue. Zeaxanthin and thiraxanthin and bioxanthin function in the xanthophyll cycling. And you can see here, here's zeaxanthin. That looks almost identical to NPQ because zeaxanthin is the one that's functioning in non-photochemical quenching. So higher amounts of NPQ and higher amounts of zeaxanthin indicate a more quote-unquote stressful environment. So the LEDs, since you sort of eliminate that potential or the possibility that plants have to sort of dissipate all that extra light that they're not using in the photosystems, if you provide them just what they need, you reduce the amount of light stress that's there, and you may provide an opportunity to elevate some of these other systems in photomorphogenesis or secondary metabolite production. So they it really boded well of what actually happened to MPQ and what were the values of zeaxanthine based on the incandescent fluorescence versus the LEDs. Okay, so in conclusion to that first study, obviously the LEDs, you know, according to the fluorocam, and certainly the xanthophyll cycle pigments create a quote-unquote less stressful environment. Higher MPQ would indicate the stress that would be under there on the incandescent fluorescence. And it's really the leaf tissue carotenoids in the xanthophyll cycle that, that complete the story and say this. It's a very dynamic cycle, and I'll show you in the next couple of slides just how easy it is as far as inducing it. And it really just follows straight ecophysiological responses in that plant. How are they going to respond to high light stress? You turn on the high light stress, zeaxanthine ramps up very quickly to dissipate that energy, et cetera. So in thinking about that, are there horticultural advantages that we can manipulate? Short bursts of light, pulses of light, we can regulate it during growth and development, time it, you know, step it up. I think the options are limitless, and certainly they're gonna be different for the species and also the environments that we have there. Okay, study number two. Okay, measuring the impacts of pre-harvest blue light on the specialty crops' nutritional values. And in this case, we kind of went away from the baby green model and went into the microgreen model, which we heard from this first speaker this morning. Grew them again in the grow chambers, optimum daylight temperatures for the sprouting broccoli microgreens, the brassica microgreens. And in this case, we chose a 24-hour photoperiod, so we didn't even flux the photoperiod. 350 micromoles, so a little bit higher than the previous study. And what we did here is we were just trying to test, can we actually apply a short burst at the end in order to sort of pre-harvest condition the plants before they went out, and what can we do to the nutritional advantage of that. So our treatments were 20% blue, 80% red. And then 5 days pre-harvest, we took half of the actual microgreens and shut off the red, 100% blue. Now, you can see there was a dramatic drop in the light intensity, so from 350 down to 41. But in that closed chamber, the only light that those plants saw for 24-hour periods for 5 days pre-harvest was blue light. So what could we do with that blue light burst at the end? And what did it do to secondary and primary metabolites? Real quickly, the data here, this we published last a year ago last January in the journal. You can see here that, you know, my initial impression is that could I induce zeaxanthine? It really didn't happen, because if you look at zeaxanthine here, it stayed the same between the continuous red-blue and then that short blue burst at the end. But what changed were beta-carotene. Okay, that significantly increased. And then if you look at the increases here in bioxanthin and certainly the xanthophyll cycle pigment. So if you remember from that first study I told you, the LEDs create a less stressful environment, and that was certainly happening here because zeaxanthin didn't elevate. So when we talked about, you know, the previous speaker talked about a little stress and how that's good, well, these weren't really stressed, so that inducible stress carotenoid zeaxanthin really wasn't affected there. If we shift to some of the glucosinolate compounds in there, and we were real excited to see what happened to glucosinolates, especially glucoprofane in here. Okay, so that's that really, that phase two anti-carcinogenic glucosinolate there. You can see here under the continuous red-blue, the levels were right around 4.06, and then here they significantly elevated under that blue treatment. So just that short burst of blue light at 5 days, 41 micromoles, was enough to elevate that really important anti-carcinogenic glucosinolate. Some changed and some didn't, but it was that one that we were really excited about is actually inducing it as far as a change. And then this was real exciting to Carl and I and Bob when we actually saw the data. What actually happened to the primary metabolites in there? Okay. Now, I didn't highlight everything in red because the whole slide would have been red, but over here on the right-hand side is the significance, but you can see some of the increases in there. You know, if you look across the macro and micronutrients, the active and the passive uptakes, it was consistent across the board. That little strobe of blue light at the end really ramped up in the microgreens levels of potassium, magnesium, iron, etc. So again, just a little shot at the end when we actually talk about that pre-harvest application could have far-reaching effects on not only the secondary metabolites, the stress response compounds, but certainly the primary metabolism in the form of the mineral nutrients. Okay, so in conclusion to this study, obviously there's relationships between the blue light exposure and the metabolic pathways, the primary and secondary metabolic pathways. Didn't really change zeaxanthine because we didn't really stress the plants enough, in our opinion. We elevated beta-carotene, glucoprofenin, and most of the mineral elements you saw there are just across the board. So there will be an impact of these blue wavelengths on gene expression within the carotenoid pathway, and certainly what it did to the other pathways. The primary pathways, especially metabolic uptake, translocation, etc., would really warrant further investigations on the mode of action, and we're in the process of doing that right now. Okay, next study, study number three. Okay, this is going to really kind of demonstrate the dynamic aspects of this anthophyll cycle. Okay, so what's really going to happen for very short durations of blue light? In this case, we use baby Toscano kale. If you're familiar with Toscano kale, it's a little bit different from what you've seen this morning. This is the long spatulate kale that's got the wrinkled leaf on it. They call it dinosaur kale. Very high nutritional value, very unique flavors that are actually associated with Toscano kale. So we grew this in the greenhouse under just optimum conditions. And then what we did is we have light banks for supplemental LED applications in the greenhouse. So we have these blue bars. I know Carrie up at Purdue has the same system here. And these are bars here that span across the top of the bench. And so what we did is we took the baby kale, grew it up to the 30-day stage, and then we dark acclimated it for an hour. Okay, so we really wanted to make sure that all the photosystems were devoid of any energy that was actually there. And we moved them under the blue panels, and it was under ambient conditions, but just that high-intensity blue light that was actually there. And so what actually happened here, here's under the blue LEDs and here's under the ambient. So we took half the plants, kind of kept them on the bench, and half the plants we actually treated. So here's time zero, and we harvested leaf tissue, flash frozen liquid nitrogen, and brought it in a lab. So here's the value, 0.4 milligrams per 100 gram fresh weight for zeaxanthin, and over here on the right is beta carotene. But you can actually see here, these are the time durations where we actually harvested the leaf tissue. So 30, 60, 120, and 240, you can see the dramatic increase in the zeaxanthin under the blue light treatment compared to the ambient, and how it would almost equilibrate down there, but it stayed relatively high. And then we saw a little bit of elevation here with the beta carotene, but that actually tailed off much greater than the actual zeaxanthin itself here. So this is a very inducible mechanism within the plants, because this is how plants actually respond to a high light environment or diurnal changes as the sun comes up and actually sun goes down. So if you can think of the horticultural advantages and the management advantage of actually pushing out products in a commercial environment that actually are elevated, and as they move to the actual production facility or the commercial facility, or you can imagine doing this during transport, where it's just the application of the blue light as they move there. Okay, and then here's just, you look in the literature, and this is actually duckweed. So this is a dramatic example of what actually happens to the xanthophyll cycle. Here's just a chromatogram of the xanthophyll cycles here, phyloxanthin and theaxanthin and zeaxanthin. And you can see here under the dark conditions, there's certainly degradation and a lowering of the zeaxanthin levels there. And this is 40 minutes under strong blue light. And in this case, they were using about 75 micromoles of the 450 nanometer blue light here. And you can see the dramatic increase in zeaxanthin, very similar to what we proved just using that application as supplemental in the greenhouse. So again, nothing new as far as the physiology crowd that's out there. Okay, so in summary up to this point, these systems, especially for the zeaxanthin and the xanthophyll cycle, very inducible under the short term, say a four-hour application. Even under the five-day exposure, you can induce not only the carotenoids but also glucosinolates and mineral elements. So obviously, nutritional advantage to proper light management. What we don't know really now, and I know we discussed this yesterday and it's certainly going to be discussed this morning, how, when, how much, and to what. So pulses, short duration, cycling, pre-harvest treatments, etc. It's going to be different for each one of the species out there, and obviously other environmental conditions will actually affect the responses in the plant tissue there. So it's not a magic bullet by any means at all. Okay, study number four. This is actually looking at, instead of having all LEDs, comparing the LEDs with a light environment or a regular light environment in the grow chamber. And in this case, we use sprouting broccoli microgreens. Okay, here's just a little graphic illustration of how we set up the grow system. This is just regular 10-20 flats, perforated flat into a solid bottom flat. And then this is just a shorter grow pad, which is really a thick gauze pad, seed right on top of it. For about 24 hours in dark conditions, they'll germinate after priming them for 24 hours. It's an ebb and flood system, so what we did is we didn't put anything over the top of the microgreens. We just filled up the bottom trough, and it actually seeped up through the weep holes and saturated the pad. And at harvest, you can pull the pad out, and you can see the roots are matted in the pad here, and it's just a clean cut with a pair of scissors, and then you get your microgreens on the top. And then from there you go. And 10-20 flats, the sure-to-grow pads come in length. They come in squares that will set right in these troughs, or you can actually buy them and roll. So it's a nice, clean system. You got to throw them out afterwards just due to the algae growth there, but it's a really nice system that we used in the grow chambers. Here's a graphic illustration of the light treatments for the particular study. 250 micromoles were our consistent light intensity, 16-hour photoperiod, consistent air temperature of 24 degrees Celsius. Here's incandescent fluorescent light treatments, and across here is just the distribution of the wavelengths from a spectroradiometer reading, very similar to the previous speaker as far as what you would expect to find under these regular light systems. And then 2, 3, 4, 5 in treatments, and the distribution of, in that 250 micromoles, what percent was blue and what percent was red. Very easy to change and modify with a spectroradiometer as far as you keep that total, and then you can adjust the wavelengths or the power that goes into the panel and what you actually get out there. So we were really trying to compare a low blue with and without green to a high blue with and without green, and then making that comparison to the regular incandescent fluorescent. Here's what happened to the biomass in the microgreens. It's a little bit tricky for microgreens because you have to normalize the biomass on the seed weight that you put in there. So I normalized it to the 7 grams of seed weight that actually went on each one of the pads here. So what you see here is the fresh weight per 7 grams of seed weight that actually went onto the pad. And this was what it was actually harvestable. So what we harvested off there, and it really didn't take into consideration the roots because that was left in the pad there. So you can see the regular light, and you can see these elevations in the fresh weight across the LED treatments, very similar to the first speaker as far as the microgreens and what it actually did to increase the amount of biomass that was actually there. And over here is a picture. I know most of you have tried to take photographs under LED light. It's very difficult. So when you do that, I really don't like to pull them out of the chamber and take them off there. I've tried tomatoes under the system, and believe me, you got to pull the tomatoes out just to see if they're actually even ripe. So they're very interesting to work with, and certainly what the responses are in the human eye. Here's the soft tissue carotenoids, and this is just what we can measure in the lab. Beta-carotene, lutein are your dominant ones that you'll find in your leafy vegetables. Neoxanthine, a little bit lower, that's the one that's immediately right before ABA production, and then your xanthophyll cyclopigments in a total here. And what I'd like to point you out to is the increase, is the increases that we actually saw in the dominant pigments of lutein and beta-carotene and then the total here. Now, zeaxanthine changed a little bit, not significantly, okay? Really not stressing the plant or the little microgreens too much. I think it's just the shorter production cycle there. But look at the increases compared to the fluorescent incandescent to the LEDs at 5% blue and the LEDs at 20% blue. And just the way that you can increase some of these light harvesting pigments there just by changing the quality of light that they're actually perceiving. So nice increases in beta-carotene and lutein, and certainly the total is actually there. Now remember, this is the microgreen model. In a second, I'll show you, say, a baby green model under the same conditions. And real quickly, just some macronutrients that were present. We actually talk about some of the tissue macronutrients. Calcium, look at the dramatic increases under the LEDs versus the regular incandescent fluorescence in the environmental chamber. Potassium especially, I mean, that went up a very large extent. Magnesium, phosphorus, and sulfur there. So again, there's got to be some link. I think there's a trigger for these blue light receptors in the plants very early on in metabolic pathways, and then it just leads to a cascading event, whether it's a genetic expression event or something that will trigger just an increase of all of these particular metabolites across the board. Okay, real quickly, study number 5. This is actually comparing regular light and increasing just blue in the blue, the red background for Chinese kale or Green Lance Chinese kale. So we brought this up to the 30-day model. Okay, the results were promising for the brassica microgreens, but what we really wanted to see is what happens if we bring this out further in growth and development. Okay, what happens if we provide an LED environment for, say, 30-day production to something that would be the size of what you'd expect to find maybe in a large baby greens salad bag in your local grocery store. So we really wanted to test this under a constant exposure for the Chinese kale over the course of growth and development. And I'll show you here in a second just what our treatments were. But by and large, we really wanted to see what would be the impacts of incrementally increasing the blue light and then comparing it back to that regular light environment. So here's another graphic illustration of our treatments. Fluorescent incandescent here was our regular light treatment. Again, we used 250, a 16-hour photoperiod, same air temperature of 24, pretty good for growing brassicas in the chambers. Here's 10 and 90, 20, 80, and 40 and 60 for our ratios of red to blue in that 250 background. Here's a picture of what the Chinese kale looked like when we pulled them out. We do this in hydroponic culture. These are just little 10-liter tubs. So here's the regular light. So you can see the biomass that's on the regular light, the 10, 90, the 20, 80, and then the 40 blue, or 40, 60. So you can see you're going to have a biomass drag because you're not going to give it the full light environment. And then look really closely, you can actually see the degree of pigmentation that's actually increasing under the 40 into the 60. Okay, so not only you get the low biomass, but you also get the increase in the pigments. So here's a graphic illustration of the fresh and dry weights of the plants. This is in the shoot tissue. So you can see here that under the regular light, they grew very well under those conditions. So they had a very high shoot biomass ratio, biomass. And you can see that they were significantly lower under the LED light treatments. And the dry weight followed the same parameters or same trends when we actually look at the shoot. Changing over to the roots, very similar. We had a little bit more of an impact on the root fresh weight and dry weight than we did under the shoot tissue. So when you actually adjust some of these, just like the previous speakers, you can actually adjust the shoot to root ratios just by changing the light exposure that's on the plant. So if you did have something that was being produced in the roots, just by tweaking this a little bit in these hydroponic models, you can actually see the amount of biomass that you could actually put on the root tissue compared to other treatments that you could choose. The carotenoids were really interesting. They really increased as far as their exposure to the LED light treatments, and you saw that in that graphical picture of the plants there. These are milligrams per gram or 100 gram fresh weight, which is what you traditionally see in the nutritional literature. Beta carotene in the orange, lutein in the light yellow here. You can see here that both of them under the regular light treatment were significantly lower than all of the LED light treatments. Trends were the same for the dry pigments on a dry mass basis. So there really wasn't a biomass dilution effect. They followed the same trends. But all the LED light treatments were significantly higher than the incandescent fluorescence. Chlorophylls, you saw this graphically in the picture there. Same trend as the carotenoids, much, you know, significantly lower under the incandescent fluorescence for chlorophyll A and chlorophyll B. And then the trends were also the same for the pigments on a dry weight basis. Real quickly here, I can segue a little bit to why it's important to eat dark green leafy vegetables. I'll put on my nutrition hat, even though I'm not a nutritionist here, is that if you look at the recommendations for USDA, they recommend 1.5 cups of dark green leafy vegetables per week. If you do the math, that's about 0.21 cups or 14 grams per day. Okay, the reality check here is that all of us don't get anywhere near that. We only consume about 4.7 grams per day. So hence this real need out there when I talk to nutritionists and they all say nutrient-dense food. The nutritionists don't care about biomass production. They all they want to know is nutrient density. So when you look at some of the treatments that we've talked about this morning, all speakers, is what are the advantages of having these nutrient-dense foods? Here real quickly is that when you look at, just for the example of the Chinese kale, is if you look at the amount of just lutein in that 14-gram serving, that's what USDA recommends, you can see the difference between the regular light treatment and the LED light treatments. And if you do the math, there's 91% more lutein in the LED treatments than there is under the incandescent fluorescence, which would be under a normal production cycle. So there is nutritional advantages. Down here on the left-hand corner, this is a picture from the Chicago-based company called Farmed Here. They do about 90,000 square feet of plant factory or urban production of arugula, baby kale, and also some other leafy greens there. And they grow them in hydroponic troughs. They have aquaponics, so they connect them to a fish production system. And they just use the fluorescent grow tubes here. And think of the advantage they could do if they shifted over to LEDs. Might be a little bit more higher cost on the front end, but certainly the advantage they could get out of actually selling this little package of nutrient-dense microgreens that they're actually promoting on their website. Real quick, we're still looking at this data, but just real quickly, as far as a macronutrient that's important in the plant, you can see the dramatic differences here between the regular light and the incandescent fluorescence, as far as the amount of potassium in the shoots and the roots on a dry weight basis. So again, inducible to promoting macronutrient uptake. And then one example of a micronutrient, iron, look a little bit different as far as, you know, its active uptake than the potassium. You can see here that there, again, is an advantage of using the LEDs for the shoot tissue, not necessarily the root tissue. So if you look at the two examples, there's one that's just promoting uptake, and then one that might be promoting translocation from the roots up to the shoots, inducible by that blue to red ratios, or changing that blue to red ratio. Okay, possible mechanisms really quickly, because I know I have to wrap up here, is that when you look at especially the impact that the LEDs are having on the carotenoids, I've come up with a couple of conclusions. Carl and I have decided, okay, some might work, some might not. We're still trying to do a lot of the research that's going to lead us to this conclusion again. But just real briefly, when you think about the light absorption and certainly the photoprotection abilities of carotenoids, the max absorption is the blue wavelengths. So if you provide them with blue light, you can think that the plant has to produce more to absorb that excess of energy just by the higher energy wavelengths. So that could be one of the reasons why we saw those dramatic increases in the carotenoids. And also this idea of zeaxanthin in the shoots. Zeaxanthin plays roles in stomatal opening and closing. So more open in the stomate, you get more uptake of certainly some of those passive elements. That could be some of the reasons for the massive uptake of some of the mineral elements that we actually saw there. And then lastly, it's really, when you look at carotenoid physiology, it's this idea of carotenoid homeostasis. Okay, there are specialized deoxygenase enzymes in the plant that regulate production and also catabolism or cleavage of those parent molecules or the parent chromophore. The cleavage products you're most familiar with, ABA is the classic example, but some of the ionones are also there. And I found a couple examples here, and really interestingly, it's actually in a petunia model where they actually talked about the impacts of some of the wavelengths that we had there. Over here on the left, you can actually see the difference in the beta ionone emission from the petunia. And beta ionone is very fragrant. It's a very aromatic cleavage product of beta carotene. And you can see here the dark right here on this one. This is white light, and it actually emits a lot more beta ionones than some of the other LED light treatments here, the blue, the red, etc. So more beta ionone emission, less beta carotene accumulation, because again, it's a cleavage product of that parent molecule. And if you look over here at the expression, the authors were actually to characterize one of the CCD enzymes in there that would actually cleave that or create beta ionone, and you can see the total expression of that was much higher under the top figure here, which is white light, and much lower under here under the blue light. So not only are they, you know, stopping beta ionone emission, but they're also showing some impact on the gene regulation itself here. So just by understanding what actually happens within the physiological aspects of the plant, you can almost come to some conclusions of what these particular wavelengths are doing to the plant itself. So real quickly, in conclusion, the studies that we've been doing in Tennessee are certainly pointing to the impact of these higher energetic blue lights, whether they're pulsed, whether they're over duration, or whether they're in high to low ratios with the red light. Actually, they're equating to not only higher carotenoids, glucosinolates, but also some of the primary and secondary mineral elements that are in the plant. When we actually talk about comparing the LEDs to traditional lighting, there certainly seems to be a nutritional advantage to create this idea of a nutrient-dense food that the nutritionists, I think, will grab on and hold to for their dear life as far as what it could actually have as far as the impact in the marketplace there. So proper light management, there's still a lot of work that has to be done, and there's going to be a lot of factors that go into actually figuring out these things on a species-by-species or a production system-by-production system basis. So what are the futures of LEDs in horticulture? I think the future is very bright by all the people who are in this room, and it's certainly an exciting area to be in as far as a crop physiologist and a horticulturalist. And whether those advantages are actually looking at a mixture of wavelength in a controlled environment or actually using them supplementation in the greenhouse, staging them over different parts of production, like I said before, I think the research opportunities are limitless when it comes to that. So I might be a little bit over, but thank you for your patience, and I hope you enjoyed it.